Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, good afternoon, and Friday, 2020, the first Friday in January 3rd. Can't believe it's 2020, can't believe it's January, and but here we are. So what's happening with the weather? Actually, I guess we should be pretty happy. The weather today is just slightly under 50 degrees. Now tonight, of course, it's been a dreary day. I guess we should expect that recently because we're having either sunny days. We've had some sunny, warm days, which are good. But this afternoon, there was a slight chance of showers. Tonight, there's a 70% chance of rain, so we have another rain is very likely. Tomorrow, we can expect rain, and tomorrow night, rain is likely. And into Sunday, at least the first part of the day, we have about a 30% chance of rain. And then it is going to be partly sunny, and Monday, actually Sunday night, there's a chance of rain and then a chance of snow, depending on how low the temperature. It's about expected to be about 29 degrees, so that rain could change into snow. And also, if there's a lot of rain, it's going to change into ice. So be careful out there. By Monday, there's about a 30% chance of snow in the morning and then mostly sunny. So pretty typical weather. Actually, other than tomorrow night, it's not getting that low tonight. They don't even expect freezing temperatures. So, other than, I don't know what's happened to the microphone or my chair, but I'm Pat Smith. The program, It's the Law, and it's Friday, and so it is the program, It's the Law. We were closed last week, and I have not been able to be here. Certain things, my husband has been ill, so we had to take some time off. But what's happening in the law, and I will be trying to get some other attorneys in to give you some specifics on some what's happening in the law and certainly in certain areas of the law. But right now, I thought this was kind of an interesting headline. And that was that the appellate court here in New Jersey ruled that 3 minutes is not sufficient time for a supermarket to be put on constructive notice of a hazard that injured a customer. In other words, you know, slip and fall in a supermarket, that's a big concern for supermarkets. If there's any kind of hazards on the floor, because if customers fall, they're obviously going to sue, etc. This was a ShopRite, but the appellate division agreed that they needed more time, more than 3 minutes, to be alerted of a hazard and to clean it up. So that's what happened in that case. And, you know, actually, there is a concern. And I'm not saying that stores should not be liable when they cause injuries, but we've all seen a situation where there's been water on the floor or something else in a supermarket, and how quickly do they have to find it and correct the problem? I think that's logical. That would be hard for most of us to see a hazard and correct it in 3 minutes. So it sounds like it was a practical decision. Now, there was, however, a man who fell down an elevator shaft in a building that was under construction at Kane University, settled his case for $3 million. So I'm sure he was seriously injured. And one of the scary things of, you know, anyone would be to fall down an open elevator shaft. So that's what happened there. There's was interesting. There was a grandparents case that was reported. I'm just trying to see if I can. I had the case, and I wanted to go over it, and maybe not. Maybe I didn't bring it. If I didn't, I will bring it next week because it had some interesting issues, and of course, it is very difficult for grandparents to get visitation with grandchildren if, in fact, the parent or parents don't agree. And in this case, the mother didn't. Sorry about that. I thought I had the case. I did have the case, and I was going to bring up some of the issues because it was there were some interesting issues here. So what else is happening? There was actually a man who suffered severe neck injuries in a motor vehicle accident, received $1 million settlement in his Morris County suit. So that I don't know if juries are being generous or if they're not being generous because of these injuries are so severe. Now, as I said, there haven't been many published cases. There have been some unpublished cases, and this was a case, initial CT versus NCP, appellate division, and the plaintiff appealed from an order, that was a 2008 order, granting custody of her then 6-year-old granddaughter to the defendant, who was the child's mother. Now, the interesting thing in this case is the child had been in the grandmother's care since birth. And as of 2018, the Division of Child Protection and Permanency, DCP&P, what we used to call DIFAS, maintained that there were no concerns with the condition of the plaintiff's home. And in this case, the defendant mother lived in a studio apartment with her fiancé. According to the caseworkers, the defendant mother's home was safe, appropriate, and passed all requirements. So each party in that case alleged some level of drug use and neglectful care at the other's residence. Before granting custody to the mother, the lower court judge found that plaintiff would be a good caretaker, but the parent's rights, or a parent's rights, to custody was paramount under case law. Although the trial judge found that defendant's living situation was not ideal, he ultimately awarded custody to the mother as she had shown her capability to care for the child, and DCP&P recommended placement with the defendant mother. On appeal, the grandmother argued that the judge erred in awarding custody to the defendant because the evidence demonstrated that defendant used drugs and provided the child with inadequate housing. Now, the appellate court affirmed the lower court's ruling, and the lower court's ruling was afforded deference if supported by adequate, substantial, credible evidence. And there was also insufficient evidence to overcome the presumption of fitness in favor of a parent. And when you are interested in that case, the case to look at that the court used was Watkins v. Nelson, 163 NJ 235. So this was pretty significant because this was a 6-year-old granddaughter who'd been in the custody of her grandmother since she was born. So even after 6 years, the mother was able to prevail. And that shows constitutionally how strong parents' rights are with respect to custody of their children. So Moriarty was the main case in New Jersey, but there are certainly other cases. Now, this was not a question of visitation. This was a question of custody, but very significant to show how difficult it is for grandparents to overcome the the burden that they have. And so that case, by the way, was not approved for publication, so it can't be cited as a case to rely on. And all of these cases, by the way, are so fact-specific. Now, the studio apartment, apparently the child's bed allegedly has a tent over the top of it. However, the caseworkers at DCP&P said the utilities work, the premises are clean, and there was food available, and it was a safe, appropriate house or residence, even though it was a studio apartment with three people living there. So in 2014, the plaintiff grandmother was awarded custody after she and the division filed custody actions. And according to the plaintiff, the defendant lost custody in 2014 after she failed to attend a drug test and a psychological evaluation. So indicating that the child remained in the grandmother's custody until 2018. And at that point, which may have been significant, the division received referrals about the child not being properly cared for by her grandmother. And apparently they received a child protective services referral that someone was bringing drugs into the grandmother's home, and also a second referral about a possible overdose. So what they found when DCP&P investigated, they found the child was being cared for by the grandmother's roommate and not the grandmother. And then they also learned that the grandmother left her sister-in-law and roommate in charge of the child's care after she was hospitalized for a broken leg. Now, frankly, since she had custody of the child, there would have been no reason for her not to provide, as long as she provided for the child's care. And that, although it was emphasized in the case, the reported case, shouldn't have made any kind of a significant difference. But apparently, the division received another referral about an adult who was yelling at a child in the street. And then although they said it was the grandmother's roommate who was yelling at the child because of her absences from school, the grandmother said her sister-in-law was the one yelling at Rose. That's the child's name. So the child then said that both the grandmother's roommate and sister-in-law were yelling at her because she did not want to go to school. And although she was crying while being yelled at, she told the caseworkers that she was not scared because the grandmother's roommate yells at her all the time. I thought that was interesting. She's not scared because the grandmother's roommate yells all the time. So in any event, DCP&P filed the complaint against the parties, and also against the child's father, alleging abuse and neglect under Title IX based on the grandmother's inability to care for the child. And in fact, the there was an emergency custody awarded to the mother, and the mother then filed a motion for custody, and there was an order granting custody to the mother, and the grandmother was granted liberal visitation at the mother's residence, and the judge placed his reasons on the record. So the trial judge, before granting custody to the mother, found that grandmother would be a good caretaker for the child, but that parents' right to custody was paramount under case law. So the thing is that although this grandmother had custody of the child since birth, there obviously were some questions about her ability to care for the child, and that obviously came into play. And what this case, as other cases show, is that if a court's decision is supported by adequate, substantial, credible evidence, then the appellate court will not overturn it. And also that the decision with respect to the proper custodial arrangement is left to the sound discretion of the trial court, unless there is an abuse of discretion. So that is very significant in all areas. The trial court is a trier of fact, and credibility will, appellate division will look to the trial court when it comes to credibility, etc. By the way, under the Watkins decision, a court must engage in a two-step analysis. First, determine whether the third party, this is third party custody, overcame the presumption in favor of the parent. And that has to be done by clear and convincing evidence. So that's a really important standard, and the standard that has to be the judge has to determine when there is a custodial arrangement and when one party seeking custody is not the parent. And they talk about exceptional circumstances, and that is, of course, the court's power to protect minor children from serious physical or psychological harm. And that's why DCPMP is able to remove children and put them into foster care. But the test does require serious proof of serious physical or psychological harm or a substantial likelihood of such harm. And that's why these cases sometimes are published, but rarely, because it's based on a case-by-case analysis. Well, let me tell you who's supporting this program and the way of sponsors, and then we'll be right back.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hi, we're back. I'm Pat Smith's program, It's the Law, talking about some of the recent cases and decisions by our courts here in New Jersey. There was actually a civil rights case, GFB versus St. James School, and that was an appellate division decision at the end of... end of December. I don't know exactly the date. It might have been the 30th of December. In any event, in this case, the plaintiffs appealed the denial of their motions for reconsideration of an order granting summary judgment to the defendants. Defendants were the St. James School. This is an action asserting racial, sexual, and religious discrimination and bullying of a child at school. Now, the child attended a private Catholic school in the school's non-Catholic curriculum, and from kindergarten through sixth grade. Now, the child's mother was a practicing Muslim, and the child practiced Islam until she, and this is a quote, fell in love with the concept of Catholicism. And the child asserted another student called her a terrorist. And the, and this was quote, terrorist, end quote, and quote, the devil's child, end quote, in fourth grade. And the child told her teacher, who accepted the other student's explanation, that the child used those terms to refer to herself in fifth grade. As herself. Then in fifth grade, other students kicked the child and accused her of having sex with a boy in the class. And those students were reprimanded in sixth grade. And the child reported that another student called her a slut. And the child was told that she was causing trouble for herself. The court noted plaintiffs did not identify the documents they contended comprised the 701 pages of their opposition to summary judgment, which they alleged the motion court did not consider. So the plaintiffs also offered no argument directed to the reconsideration standard. And there is, in fact, a standard for motions on reconsideration. And you can't just file a motion for reconsideration because he didn't like the result. So they offered no argument directed to the reconsideration standard, the anti-bullying Bill of Rights, in this case, was not applicable because defendant was not a public school district. And charitable immunity, the act, there is a charitable immunity act, barred their negligence claims and plaintiff's proposed amendments to the complaint were not sustainable as a matter of law. So this is a case where if the same thing happened in a public school, they may well have been able to proceed, but they couldn't because this was a Catholic school and there was charitable immunity, and that act barred negligence claims, and that's all they had. So the this was somebody, petitioner appealed the forfeiture of his entire pension service credit for misconduct. So this is Board of Trustees Police and Firemen Retirement System. Now, the petitioner was hired as a police officer in 1990 and spent most of his career with the Narcotics Division. In 2010, the FBI sought petitioner's cooperation in the investigation of fellow officers, and he decided to cooperate. The FBI was also investigating petitioner's sexual relations with minors. And a minor told the FBI that petitioner had paid him for sex acts and told him to lie. Petitioner was recorded telling the minor to lie to the FBI about their relationship. In that case, the FBI charged the petitioner with obstruction of justice and witness tampering. And he actually pled guilty to one count in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1512, etc. And he, as a result, he received notice of disciplinary action and was terminated from his job. Now, he applied for service retirement with 20 years of credit while the criminal charges were pending. And the board found that petitioner's entire service and salary credits was to be forfeited due to his dishonorable service. Now, that meant that was the board, and then the administrative law judge found that petitioner obstructed justice to avoid criminal charges and that his obstruction of justice impacted his official duties. And his misconduct demonstrated a substantial moral turpitude, and total forfeiture of the pension was appropriate. Petition argued that the forfeiture was excessive since his misconduct was unrelated to his official duties. And the court on appeal, this was the appellate division, noted the petitioner did not deny his offense and agreed that his misconduct was directly related to his employment, and the court agreed that his misconduct was directly related to his employment as a police officer. So this is very, very significant. And of course, since I do family law, my question would have been, what, if any, rights would his spouse have had based on the fact that if he was married and the parties were divorced, she'd have a right to equitable distribution of his pension. So it's pretty harsh if, in case he was married, that his spouse was also forfeited any rights if she did, and that was not the issue in this case. But very interesting issue. What rights, if any, would she have if, in fact, he had to forfeit his pension? And the more interesting question, or at least an interesting question in this case, was it looks like this had to do mainly with his sexual conduct, which would have nothing to do with his wife if he was married. And, of course, then the lying and the cover-up. So there was another case in the matter of Na, appellate division. The petitioner appealed the decision finding him ineligible for supplemental compensation on retirement benefits. And the petitioner was a clerk driver with the Office of the Public Defender, and he was issued a preliminary notice of disciplinary action, suspending him for 45 days. And then 5 months later, the public defender issued a second notice seeking his removal. The parties entered into a settlement, meaning the public defender and the plaintiff entered into an agreement, and the settlement agreement at a hearing in which petitioner agreed to resign and never again to seek work for the public defender. And the public defender withdrew the disciplinary notices and allowed petitioner to resign in good standing. So the petitioner argued that the denial of benefits was erroneous because he was not removed for cause and he did not retire in lieu of removal. He contended he resigned in good standing and in lieu of pursuing the disciplinary grievance process. So the commission rejected that argument and the court agreed. The court agreed that what the commission did was reasonable under the circumstances. So that is how that happened. And certainly we're upholding, in most of these cases, either the trial judge or the administrative law judge. Well, I'm just trying to... a couple other things were not... I don't think they were that much interest to the general public. There's another civil rights case. This was the defendant in this case, Department of Corrections. The defendant was the Department of Corrections. Appealed the jury verdict awarding emotional distress and punitive damages, and that was a hostile work environment action. This is pretty important, these cases. And the plaintiff worked as a correction officer and assertive. Well, let me see who's on the phone here. Hello? Well, that was not a call. Can you imagine we get those robocalls even at the radio station? This was not a call. I thought it might be someone calling in to comment on the program or to actually to talk about a case that I had expected someone to call in about. Instead, it was one of those, what do I want to call them? I'm going to be nice and not say anything. So get back to the civil rights of the correction officer, and plaintiffs said there were gender-based discrimination, including the spread of rumors that she was having an extramarital affair with a high-ranking prison official. And both parties denied the affair, but rumors continued to spread. And multiple colleagues suggested plaintiff received preferential treatment because of the affair. And a lieutenant told two sergeants that he did not, and I won't say this on the radio, but he did not give a F who the plaintiff F'd to get this job, and that he would, quote, burn her, end quote. He made similar comments to the plaintiff. Plaintiff's supervisor told various lieutenants that the plaintiff was protected by the affair and told co-workers to be careful around plaintiff because she, quote, might tell, end quote. An officer asked the plaintiff if she planned to perform a sex act on the prison official. Plaintiff complained to EEO/AA liaison about the rumors multiple times. Plaintiff alleged gender-based hostile work environment in violation of the law against discrimination. Defendant argued plaintiff failed to establish a prima facie case, and the court found rumors of sexual relationships could satisfy the first prong of the layman test. And this is a test that they have to look at, and that rumors of affairs with supervisors could constitute sex-based harassment of women. So additionally, the defendant failed to demonstrate it was only entitled to rely on affirmative defense. So in this case, they lost, and the plaintiff won. So important whether or not it stops any of this kind of harassment and allegations. Another thing. But at least someone was vindicated and did not have to put up with this. There was a third-party defendants in this case appeal from an order denying their motion to compel arbitration with the defendant. And the defendant operated an independent lab that provided toxicology and drug testing and other lab services. The defendant entered a lab management services agreement with third-party defendants for management and operational services for the defendant's lab. And this kind of goes on and on, but the court had to interpret the clause, and it said that they had reasonable notice that the parties were waiving their right to judicial adjudication of their claims. And so that in this case, they lost. The court held that the arbitration clause clearly and unambiguously expressed the party's intent to give the arbitrator the authority to determine whether it was something to arbitrate or not. So, okay, let's come back after a minute, hearing from various sponsors and the chamber.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, we're back, and actually I'm going to talk about a family law case because I think that, first of all, you know, even though I do family law, and that's all I do is handle family matters, the last thing anyone wants to do is go to trial and even more so an appeal. I'm in the middle of handling a very complicated appeal, and it's, to say the very least, very difficult. So, however, one of the issues in this case was the wife received Social Security disability payments. So that is an issue, and it's always something that people need to look at. In this case, she was already suffering from multiple sclerosis, MS, when they married. And the Social Security Administration had determined that she was disabled, and for that reason she was unemployed. And so that is, one of the issues that the judge had to determine, whether or not there should be income imputed to her other than the Social Security benefits. Now, if anyone has a question, is disability is defined by the Social Security Act as the, quote, inability to engage in any substantial gainful activity by reason of any medically determinable physical or mental impairment which can be expected to result in death or which has lasted or can be expected to last for a continuous period of not less than 12 months. That's a quote from 42 USC. Now, also, an individual shall be determined to be under a disability only if his physical or mental impairment or impairments are of such severe, of such severity that he is not only unable to do his previous work, but cannot, considering his age, education, and work experience, engage in any other kind of substantial gainful work which exists in the national economy. So that is, and in this case, this woman did qualify for Social Security, permanent Social Security disability payments, and significant. So what else is happening in this case? And this, as I said, was an appeal. So this is the appellate division. And the former wife appealed from portions of the final judgment of divorce that fixed the amount of alimony and child support to be paid by her husband and further directed her to pay the daughter's unreimbursed medical expenses. And she also appealed from the order denying her motions for reconsideration. So she argued that the family part judge erred in calculating alimony and child support by imputing income to her and by failing to impute income to her husband. And she also said the judge failed to consider her need for need for spousal support. And the judge also abused her discretion by deviating from the child support guidelines. And the guidelines are quoted in this case. So the appellate division concluded that the trial judge improperly imputed income to the defendant wife, but not to the plaintiff husband, and did not explain her findings as to the defendant's need for support or the plaintiff's ability to pay, and incorrectly deviated from the guidelines. And for those reasons, the court vacated the alimony and child support and remanded to the trial court. And that's often what happens, is the court won't make a new decision. They'll just remand it back to the trial court and tell the trial court to redo it, a do-over. So the facts in this case is that the parties were married in 2000, had a child in 2004, and separated in 2012. At the time the parties were married, as I said, the defendant wife already suffered from MS, and they were married in 2000, and then in 2002, after the marriage, Social Security determined she was disabled. Doesn't surprise me that it took that long. It often does take. And most people who go in for and apply for Social Security disability, it's pretty common to get turned down the first time and then have to go back on appeal. So in this case, the defendant wife was unemployed, and the plaintiff husband had been employed full-time since 2013 in a commission-based job and apparently earned approximately $150,000 annually during the 2 years before trial. And so in this case, they looked at 2 years before trial. And it depends on the situation, but if someone's income has really dropped, they take a look at why. And I won't go into exactly, you know, why his salary had dropped, but the point is the court imputed income to the wife and should have looked to the husband to see if he could be earning more money than he was earning. In this case, there was a 13-day trial, so it looks to me as if most of it was dealing with the custody. And what they did is the trial court did, and this is unusual, granted the defendant wife, sole legal custody, and barred any parenting time for the plaintiff father until further order of the court. And what is to support, the judge rejected the wife's monthly budget of approximately $7,700 and reduced it to $4,300. And the judge found that many of her expenses were fictional, and her budget did not reflect the assistance she was receiving from her parents when she was separated. He did not find that the $7,700 a month was realistic. So after imputing income to her, the judge ordered the plaintiff to pay imputed that income to her amount of, after imputing income, $240 a week to her, then the judge awarded the alimony, and he deviated from the child support guideline worksheet by only ordering $90 a week child support. So that's when she filed a motion, etc., and went up to the appellate division. And of course, the judge recognized after the motion that she did not give any reasons for deviating from the guidelines, and then in an oral decision clarified that she found good cause, and that's what they have to do to deviate from the guidelines. And so she said she found good cause. And said an injustice would occur if plaintiff was required to pay child support pursuant to the guidelines because, and the quote was, he is not going to see his child. And also that the parents and the child contributed equally to the circumstances that led to granting sole custody to the defendant and denying the plaintiff any, in other words, to the mother, and denying the father any parenting time. So that's why it went up on appeal. And again, the court talks about the limitation of their review and how they can and do review and remand to the trial court if, in fact, the Not the factual conclusions, but the legal conclusions are wrong. And they went into good discussion as to why that happened in this particular case before they remanded it. Well, those of us who are practicing in New Jersey and enjoy history, we're happy to hear, and it's in the future, but presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin is going to give the keynote speech at the 2020 New Jersey State Bar Association annual meeting and convention. This is held May 13th to May 15th in Atlantic City at the Borgata, and she's going to be a big draw. She really will. But this is a meeting where attorneys throughout the throughout the state get together, and lots of good seminars, lots of good food, and other things. So, what else in the couple minutes that we have? So, there was there's some criminal law cases not for publication. As I said, there really wasn't much in the way of published cases. And I think it's with the holidays, everything is a little bit slower. But we did hear that Johnson & Johnson prevailed in two TAC trials in the span of a week after a St. Louis jury rejected claims that the company's baby powder caused a woman's ovarian cancer. Those cases are proceeding throughout the country. And that one in St. Louis, they said, nope, didn't happen. There wasn't the reason for it. So I'm welcoming my friend and co-host, Bill, who came in just a couple minutes early, not much. Thank you, Bill, for being here. Anything new in the bankruptcy area that you want to tell people about?
Well,
wind up that way?
Well, it's another year. We now have a new bankruptcy chapter that becomes effective February 1. It's called Chapter 5. It's there for small businesses. No need for a lot of the heavy, intensive paperwork that we had for Chapter 11. So Congress is making it a little easier, but there'll be trustees appointed instead of, although there will also be debtors in possession, so it's going to be an interesting thing. Nobody's quite sure how it's going to work. I'm a little embarrassed to say I haven't really studied the legislation. I know it's there. I know it's out. For people who have small businesses and business problems, these Chapter 5s may be a good idea.
No, there has never been a Chapter 5 up until now?
No, we have Chapter 7,
okay,
which is
right.
A straight liquidation. We have Chapter 11, which are for companies or businesses, partnerships, individuals who owe more than they are allowed to in a Chapter 13, to be in a Chapter 13. And we have Chapter 12s, which I think are for family farmers. I've never done one. I've never done a Chapter 12, but they're for family farmers, and they run a lot like Chapter 13s. Additionally, we have Chapter 15s, which are for large corporations that have business and assets across borders. So if you are a shipping company with a port, say, in Los Angeles and another one in China and another one in Korea, Chapter 15 might fit because there are cross-border rules. More commonly, we see those with companies that have offices and assets, both say in the U.S. and Canada or in the U.S. and Mexico.
Well, can such companies file under 13 or not?
They can file under Chapter 15.
But can they file under 13 or are they
to
Chapter 15?
Chapter 13s are only for us flesh and blood individuals. You have to be a physical human being to file a Chapter 13.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Well, then, what? And just briefly tell our audience, what's the difference? Because if you're an individual, you file under Chapter 7. And in other words, and when I said 13, I should have said, can a company or business who files an 11, Chapter 11, can they have international involvement, or do they have to if they have any international, and I don't know how much involvement, but are they limited to Chapter 15?
The answer to that is, unfortunately, I don't know. In a Chapter 11, if your principal assets are here in the United States, then certainly you can file here. And certainly your principal assets should be, say, in New York or New Jersey or Delaware or Pennsylvania. Well, then you would file in that state, and you would file in the designated city where there's a bankruptcy court in that district within that state. On the other hand, if you have cross-border assets that are going to need to apply both American law and foreign law, because foreign law and American law differ so much, you will find that there's a need. Congress found that there was a need to find a way to harmonize these cross-border cases in ways that made sense in both countries. Made sense for creditors, made sense for shareholders who had stock, and also made sense for the debtor, the entity that has to file a bankruptcy. So one of the problems that happens is, particularly in logistics and transportation companies that deal with shipping, is you have a ship that may be registered in Liberia or Panama. It's owned by an American company, but it's leased to a Norwegian company. And registration doesn't mean you're registering who owns it. It means you're registering it in a foreign country because their regulations are less for how you deal with your crew. Certain pay requirements, certain insurance requirements, and things like that that I'm not completely familiar with. So there has to be a way of kind of harmonizing all of that and kind of herding all of those cats into one parade.
Well, you'll certainly be, you know, looking into the differences between this Chapter 5 and Chapter 11 as new clients come in to determine whether they're better off filing under the Chapter 5 or Chapter 11. And I think at this point we're going to play the news, and then we'll come back with the sports guys. So stay with us.
I'm raring to go, Pat.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial Advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heide and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
In his first statement since the death of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani, President Trump says America has the best military in the world and warns terrorists, "We will find you, we will eliminate you."
If Americans anywhere are threatened, we have all of those targets already fully identified, and I am ready and prepared to take whatever action is necessary.
Senators are back on Capitol Hill after the holiday break, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky says the Senate should follow the same precedent set during President Clinton's impeachment trial.
The structure for this impeachment trial should track with the structure of the Clinton trial. We have a precedent here.
The House is back in session starting on Monday, and you're listening to USA Radio News.
Hi, everyone. Wayne Alarouche. Listen carefully to another great offer on one of the most sought-after assets on Earth. The world of political turmoil just gets crazier and crazier. Impeachment hearings, China trade wars, Fed money pumping, which are creating bubbles that could burst any day now, with one exception.